Well, I'm Sheldon Brown and host of Mental Health Radio, and we've been listening to our theme music from Joe Cocker called Respect Yourself, with some great messages about respecting ourselves and others. Mental Health Radio is brought to you and funded by Ember Wellbeing Trust. Today we are shining a light on creative approaches to wellbeing with guest Daniel Goodwin. Daniel has 12 years in theatre and is a performance poet and writer-director who contributed his wisdom on creativity and mental health at a shared vision celebration last month, late in September. That was run by Hearts and Minds and Shared Vision, and got a reasonable sort of a turnout. Now, in his younger days, Daniel used to boldly proclaim, "I am a schizophrenic," a phrase which he said used to be empowering for him. He's changed his approach more recently after returning to New Zealand from the UK. Today he gains empowerment from his art, theatre and poetry. Well, welcome, Daniel, to Mental Health Radio. Take it from us, how was the Uber ride today?
Kia ora. It was good. Speedy, friendly.
Oh, good.
Yeah, running a bit late, but we're there.
So you're a great user of Uber?
Not so much, actually. I'm more of a walker. Right. I've been told that I walk far too quickly. I don't know what that means, but
you're not obsessive about walking.
No, but I steam ahead. Right. Steam ahead, I think.
So at what age did you first get a mental health diagnosis?
22 is the official diagnosis, I believe. And then in conversations in and out for a few years before that.
So you were living in the UK then, or you were in New Zealand?
Yeah, no, I was in the UK. I was studying theatre. I was doing my master's in London and was diagnosed halfway through that. Yeah.
So it sounds as though this diagnosis could have related to study and being at university, perhaps being under some degree of pressure. Is that the case?
I think the opposite, actually. Academics, university has always been kind of a safe space for me in terms of exploration and questioning and inviting those kind of questions. Stressful, for sure, definitely stressful. And I think stress is sometimes a hard thing to kind of appreciate when it is too much before it right. gets to that point. I was mugged in London while studying, so maybe the two combined, but I would say the mugging was more more of a factor than anything else, really.
So you say that quite casually, but what happened in this mugging? I mean, were you attacked?
It's almost something that you have to take off your bucket list when you're living in London. Awful joke, but
you've got to put it on your bucket list.
You've got to put it on your bucket list to begin with. Yeah. I was walking through a park in the middle of the week in broad daylight at around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which is not the typical time that you'd expect something like that to happen. But yeah, no one else was around and I got jumped by three kids in a park.
And what happened next?
And after that, set off my first essentially psychotic episode, I suppose, if that's what you'd...
So, I mean, did you... Well, just to go back to that mugging, these three kids were out to rob you or just to harm you?
Yeah, they were out... They told me to hand my phone over, and I remember really distinctly one of them said, "Do you want to get poked?" Which I'd never heard before, but I assumed it meant he wanted to stab me. So I, gave my phone and then kind of wallop, punch in the face on the ground. Yeah.
That was from one of them. What did the other two do?
They just joined in. Right. They just joined in. They were having a grand old time.
So what happened next? I mean, were you so badly injured that you had to seek medical advice? Or?
I wasn't. For me, episodes of psychosis, especially acute ones, have always come with dissociation and some really bad shaking and tremors as well. So someone actually came across me in the park and phoned an ambulance because I was in this kind of state of real panic, essentially. An ambulance team came and actually, they didn't take me to hospital. One of them sat with me and had a conversation for about half an hour. A really lovely conversation. He finished it by handing me one of his he had a little torch. I think they all had this kind of like set gear. And so he gave me a torch and he said, the next time something like this happens, wrap this in the middle of your hand and just wallop. Just go for time back.
To strengthen your fist up. So really?
Yeah. Questionable advice. But I think that gives a kind of illustration of what London can be like sometimes. Yeah.
So just to clarify, this traumatic incident, this mugging, was that the result of, or that the outcome of that was that you were made aware of some vulnerability to psychosis?
Yeah. The woman that came across me in the park had a conversation with the ambulance member, and police were also on the scene at that time as well. So they took a statement and did their work as well. While I was having a conversation with the ambulance driver, he was asking those kind of questions of, has anything like this happened before? Which it had, but not to that kind of extent. And I said yes. And yeah, he recommended that I go and, very lightly, that I go and chat with someone about it.
Yeah. So the symptoms that you were revealing, you've touched on those. You were shaky, panicky, and was there some psychotic impact as well?
There was, yeah. For a few years up until that point, and this is kind of in retrospect that I realized this, had been hearing voices. But never more than whispers, and not something that I'd kind of identified as voices or as psychotic experiences. And so I experienced those all while studying back in Otago years before. And then after that incident, it was almost like a volume knob just increased, really, and they became a lot more distressing and uncertain. And yeah, this phenomenon, I suppose, that I just kind of pegged down to imagination before that point, suddenly I was like, this is something that I need to talk about. And over the next coming weeks, as I kind of went into that, it became louder and louder and more distressing, along with visual hallucinations as well. So
I mean, what happened to your sleep? Did you have nightmares about this mugging? Or
I did, yeah. That was the first time that I'd ever, going back to that park, because it was quite close to my home, so, and I went there quite frequently whenever I wanted to go for a walk or de-stress or whatever. That was the first time I'd ever encountered that feeling of, I can't step back into this
right
space just yet. It took me a little while to go back there.
So the mental health diagnosis, it was suggested by the ambulance team that you might, it might be wise to go and talk to somebody. Who did you find to talk to?
I went to my GP first, actually. I went to my GP first and we had conversations about depression. We had conversations about anxiety, and then she picked up on me shaking. So I was shaking quite consistently at the time, and she picked up on something really specific. Actually, I was latching onto tables and to walls to kind of get a sense of bearing. And so she commented on that and she was like, what is this? Is this something? What is this trying to accomplish? And so we had a conversation about that. Almost my attempts to kind of ground myself before I knew what grounding was, essentially. And so she saw that and then sent me on to a mental health specialist who I think was a nurse. Never actually introduced his profession, but he started asking questions and then he passed me on to a doctor who asked the same questions, and then she passed me on to another doctor, which was in a kind of mental health intensive care unit that I ended up going to weekly.
So you were almost sort of passed on to these people without an explanation of what was happening to you. That's what it sounds like.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I had those conversations about depression and anxiety, which I wish I had had more time for, because those are still quite relevant in my life and they get overshadowed a bit. But no, yeah, then I got passed on to the next professional, and they started using words like bipolar was tossed around, psychosis, and then I think it was, yeah, two doctors down the track, paranoid schizophrenia kind of came into the picture. And
but it turned out, in fact, that that wasn't an accurate diagnosis.
No. Since then, doing a lot of work with services in New Zealand has kind of illuminated on those experiences a little bit more. Yeah, rather than talking about symptoms per se, New Zealand services have talked a lot more about my history and my experiences and the ways that I've kind of interacted with the world, and that those conversations have kind of picked apart a whole bunch of different justifications for the symptoms or the experiences of psychosis. And yeah, schizophrenia doesn't feel right anymore. Yeah.
You did, in the early days, proclaim that I am a schizophrenic, and did, and apparently that was quite empowering for you. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It's a controversial statement. I am schizophrenic, yeah. At the time when I was first diagnosed, and I think this is the case for quite a lot of people, it was really empowering. And it's not where I am now, it's not an empowering thing for me today, but at the time I want to really honour that it was empowering, because it was a way of adding certainty and a definite kind of understanding, something that I could like hold on to, you know. It was something that I could give shape to and give meaning to.
So it was a diagnosis that you could do some research on and build your awareness and understanding of what you might be experiencing.
I mean, the thing is, schizophrenia, when I was diagnosed, it was a word that was kind of passed around me rather than in conversation with me. So doctors would talk to each other, would talk to nurses, would talk to care workers, and you'd see the language kind of being tossed around outside of you, and you would see the effect it would have. Schizophrenia is such a loaded term, you could see instantly the changes on nurses' faces, on care workers' faces.
And, so that, you know, that was not a happy look on their faces. No. That was a look of real concern,
yeah,
and perhaps some fear that you could be dangerous.
Yep. It was almost like hopelessness. You'd see the kind of energy just fade from them, and suddenly it almost felt like they became exhausted, like they had been told this so many times before, and they tried so hard to kind of try and support, and yeah, I think.
But I've had an instance where, after being in a treatment center, many years going back to the 80s, and apparently the psychiatrist, he never told me, but in a later conversation with my ex-wife, he said, oh, well, the psychiatrist said you were bipolar. Well, the psychiatrist never told me I was bipolar.
First time I've heard of it.
First time I've heard of it. And in doing a bit of research on bipolar, well, there are certain symptoms that I don't believe that I have ever sort of revealed or acted out, or you know, gone manic with money, or gone manic in a nightclub and want to party up until 3 or 4 in the morning.
Yeah.
I would sometimes wish I...
Right? It's like, where are all the fun things that I could have been doing?
Well, right. So, you know, this bipolar didn't seem to be very real to me. I mean, I understand now, having worked in mental health for 13 years or so, that it's often difficult to differentiate between bipolar and depression, and I own up to anxiety and depression. Well, let's take a music break on Take It From Us, and today we are playing Crowded House.
Just said, don't walk away. Down on my knees, but please.
Well, this is Take It From Us, Mental Health Radio on Planet FM. And today we are talking to Daniel Goodwin. He is a performance poet. He's been in theatre 12 years, a writer and director. And later in the show, we are going to get on to shining a light on the importance of creativity, the positive importance of creativity to one's mental well-being. And just to sort of lead into that, Daniel, you've since learnt a new way of expressing your diagnosis. And how important is that? Well, tell us what that is first.
Jumping back to the beginning again, for me, it's about respecting people at all stages of their journey at whatever place they might be, you know. Again, like I said in the beginning, saying I am a schizophrenic was a way of giving some certainty to a diagnosis which, not just for me but for people around me, was really uncertain, you know. The amount of symptoms that schizophrenia, you know, can be applied to is so vast, and I've displayed only a few of them, and that's a really difficult place to exist in. Since kind of living with my experiences and working through them with art, becoming more used to them just over time and finding ways to cope and work through them and work with them, along with that kind of develops a sense of comfort, I think. And we come with that comfort, we kind of settle with our language and with our expression. And I think that need to cling to something quite so adamantly is kind of relaxed a little bit. So that's the journey that I've kind of gone on. And I suppose the place where I'm at now, especially with the work that I do and the creative work that I make, I suppose, yeah, I'm at a place where, I mean, my privilege as a theatre maker and a poet, right? Words are kind of the thing that I use every day. So right. I get to be really playful with that, and I get to really break down what some people take as certain and need to be certain. I can kind of break down and relax and take from different perspectives.
I think comfort for me comes from long periods of wellness. So if I can achieve wellness over long periods of time, then it takes away the mental health vulnerability. It's only when that vulnerability comes back that I become a bit fearful that I may have another episode. So is that something that you've been able to sort of put runs on the board, have long periods of time where you're comfortable with your emotional and mental health?
Definitely. I mean, that's for me is a practical and an ideological thing. You know, I've developed habits and routine and responses, practical responses to my experiences, which help me work through them and settle them a little bit more. And then also I found ways of talking about my experiences using language that feels right for me. You know, I'm so adamantly of the opinion that language as a tool should be empowering for the person using it. You know, I think that's such an important part of feeling in control and settled and safe with your experiences.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about your vulnerabilities publicly now. I mean, you were one of a team from Artify that spoke at a shared vision celebration of community well-being
in
September. And so what do you get out of that?
I suppose the thing for me, and actually for Artify in general, the thing that we try and accomplish as much as possible is we try and facilitate space, essentially, which people can come into and operate and be themselves safely. And especially we work with people who that sense of self might be quite an uncertain thing at some point. Often, especially working in mental health, peer support or whatever kind of capacity, I find a lot of young people asking for answers, you know, that kind of cliche of going to a therapist and getting really angry because they didn't tell you what to do, they didn't give you any answers. And for me, it's a big part of what we do is about shifting that and saying, actually, what we're trying to do is let you ask questions and let you find whatever answers in whatever words you want to use, because that's the important thing. How do you understand what is going on for you? Yeah, we can work with whatever you're giving us. Yeah, whatever is happening, whatever you give us, we can work with. That's the kind of offering that we're trying to give. And yeah, that takes the form of space and giving people time and tools to ask those questions and come up with those answers and find language that works
right
for them, you know, which is different for everyone.
So, I mean, I guess the reality in our emotional health or mental health is that we have to be personally responsible for how we live our lives, how we benefit our well-being, whether we take our medication or not, whether we eat well and exercise, all of those sorts of things. You mentioned that you were doing quite a lot of walking. What are some of the things? Well, obviously, let's talk about art and creativity. How has that helped your well-being?
Totally. I thought you were about to say, let's talk about walking for a second.
Well, I nearly did, but I realized that art and creativity were much more important.
Maybe more important. Well, I mean, walking for me turned from something I used to do for about 6 to 8 hours a day into something that I've, it turned into a real kind of unhealthy coping strategy for a while. And it's something that I've kind of got back under control.
Really?
Yeah.
So you were quite obsessed by walking?
Yeah, I used to walk. There was when I came back to New Zealand, there was an estuary in Orewa, and I used to do circles of it all day for maybe, 6 to 8 hours.
I've cycled around that particular estuary.
It's a beautiful estuary. It's a beautiful estuary.
Right.
I know it like the back of my hand.
So what do you think was happening there? Why were you spending 6 to 8 hours walking round and round there?
I think at the time, and again, I suppose this will kind of transition it into creativity, which is maybe more interesting, but walking is fascinating. But I think for me, it was a way of processing. It was a way of moving. Something that I try and reinforce for other people quite a lot is, as long as you're moving, as long as you're finding ways to grow and understand and develop whatever pace or form that takes, you know, as long as you're doing that work, you're fine. We can work with whatever that looks like, you know.
So that moving is something like that's incorporating theater and even spoken word, poetry, that sort of thing, because you can be moving and express it while you're expressing that.
Yeah, I mean, walking was a way of giving me something to do that let me process. I used to do a lot of thinking. I don't do that anymore, but being an artist, being a poet, being a theater maker gives me a really specific set of tools to take my experiences and try and communicate them through that format, you know. I mean, that's all art is, essentially, is a form of communication. I've got something that I want to say to you, and I'm going to say it in this specific way because that's going to amplify or convey the meaning in a more interesting and nuanced way than just trying to say what it is outright, you know.
So did you bring any of your poetry along today?
I did. Yes, I will just get it up for you.
So you talk about, you use the word spoken word rather than poetry. Is this a sort of a new genre, if you like?
I think the thing I like about spoken word is, it sounds really bad to call it generalized, but I think the thing that I like about it is spoken word kind of implies a blank slate, you know. It's quite relaxed, easy. Oh, it's words that are spoken. That's not really a it's not a direct statement, you know, whereas I think poetry can sometimes carry a lot of meaning before you actually get into the poetry.
Well, poetry, you know, sort of demands that it's rhyming.
Yeah,
I mean, that might be a very old-fashioned outlook on poetry, but okay, you've got something there on the phone, have you?
I do. I've got something up. This is a new one. I've been writing a lot about overwhelm right now, which I think is something that people in the mental health community can
understand and very much appreciate.
But I think it's something everyone can understand. I think everyone knows that feeling, that fear of being too much, or that exhaustion that comes when life is a little bit too much. So I quite enjoy
burnout.
Burnout. I think overwhelm is a nice something that everyone can experience.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Well,
here's Daniel Goodwin with a piece of spoken word.
Hypothetical. If a time bomb asks you for a hug, should you give it one? Scenario one, you can hear the ticking. Scenario two, say that you can't. In fact, this time bomb hasn't ticked in a long time. Hypothetical, if a time bomb isn't ticking anymore, is it still a bomb? Or just a small bag for dynamite? Scenario three, the bomb has the body of a basketball, cartoon round, and a smiley face. The face may or may not be a Japanese anime sticker, but still. Scenario four, the bomb has put on a onesie in an attempt to look adorable. It is now a bag inside of a bag. Oh God, it's working. It makes you kind of uncomfortable. Scenario five, time bomb is an adult. Why is it infantilizing itself by wearing a onesie? Hypothetical, is a bomb only a bomb because of its ability to blow up? How do you exist outside of your function? Scenario 6. The bomb has been trying new things with its fuse. A ponytail, a comb-over, ombre. It wanted to make a good impression. Scenario 7. A friend says to the bomb, why do you care? You're a time bomb. Your fuse doesn't mean anything. It doesn't matter. What matters is what's on the inside. Dynamite on a timer. Hypothetical. If a time bomb has a timer that you can't see or hear, does Schrodinger get jealous? And are they always in a state of both counting down and genuinely fine? Scenario 8. If time bomb asks for a conversation instead of a hug, do you stay and talk? If they say they're fine, how do you know they're lying? Scenario 9. Is proximity the problem? Scenario 10. If it says it will step back when it knows it is about to blow, do you trust it? Scenario 11. Time bomb has started texting you at a minute past midnight. Every time you see their name come up on your phone, you feel suddenly exhausted. Scenario 12. You shouldn't resent them so much. But you do. Scenario 13. Time bomb has started saying they're fine, even though we know that they're not. Saying things like, it's all I talk about. I don't want to be a burden. Scenario 14. A time bomb is a burden. Scenario 15. But how does a time bomb outrun itself? Scenario 16. When someone calls you overwhelming, it does not mean you are overwhelming. It means they are overwhelmed by you. Their reaction and your state of being are separate phenomenon. Hypothetical, if a bomb goes off, do you blame the fire or the dynamite? The difference between a time bomb and dynamite is that for a time bomb, detonation is inevitable. It is a legitimate fear for everyone involved. The problem is not proximity. The problem is not fear. The problem is certainty. Time bomb knows it is a bomb, but how does a time bomb outrun itself? Scenario 17, everyone is a burden. Reframe that word. Everyone breathes in both directions. Everyone takes up space. Everyone demands something of something else. Breathe in, breathe out. This world does owe you something. I am sick of stable people saying it does not. We are in debt with each other. Debt to the planet. Oh, kindness, respect, commitment. Breathe in, breathe out. Conclusion. I've been an element of other people's overwhelm. Other people have been an element of mine, the thing that's always missing. We're all time bombs trying not to blow up. Be honest when you're overwhelmed. Be honest to those who overwhelm you. You do not need to blow up to rebuild yourself. If two time bombs blow up next to each other, which one is to blame? The one that's crazy or the one that tried to jump ship? Who gives a shit? We're all trying to not blow up.
Thank you, Daniel. Well, let's take another music break with Crowded House, and we'll be back to talk to Daniel Goodwin after the music. We're on Take It From Us, Mental Health Radio on Planet FM, and we're talking to Daniel Goodwin. And Daniel shared a spoken word piece of creativity. And essentially that was about overwhelm, Daniel. So I mean, overwhelm is pretty common these days, isn't it? I was in the Countdown supermarket yesterday afternoon, and there was a gentleman there who did look pretty stressed, and the machine that he was using to try and buy his groceries seemed to fail him. And the second time or third time it did, he just yelled across the supermarket and said, look, it's gone down again, you know. And everybody looked at him. But he did look like a man who was overwhelmed. So what's your exposure to people that are overwhelmed?
That's such an interesting example, I think, the checkout kind of more and more. I think we live in a world where we're kind of geared towards efficiency and speed. We want to do things faster and quicker. You know, we're always trying to make everything a little bit easier for us and move a little bit faster. And I think overwhelm sometimes in that world is what results when something goes wrong in that system, which is working quite fast and is trying to move faster. Yeah, when things go wrong, I don't think we're always well equipped to deal with that.
Maybe that's because we're so wired and used to things going fast, and you know, social media is probably fueling this. And
100%. Yeah,
I must say, right at the moment, I am fearful of something going wrong in my life because I know I don't have the resources to address that.
So many of the interactions that communication, you know, happens instantaneously nowadays. We're no longer writing letters. You can fly to another country in 12 hours rather than on a boat. That's horribly uninformed, but
it probably took me about 9 weeks to get to the UK from New Zealand. I did stop off in Southern Africa and also in the Mediterranean. But, you know, that was the reality that
100. Yeah, I think more and more we don't.
Not 100 years ago, almost.
But I think more and more we're in a world where we forget how to stop and slow down and take in our surroundings, I think.
How do you stop?
For me, I have to kind of pencil in specific moments for stopping, I think. And actually, I think that can be quite a useful habit for lots of people, specifically making time for rest, and specifically for rest where you kind of stop taking in stimuli. There's so much stimulus everywhere, TV, media, whatever. That's kind of a cliche shorthand, but we're constantly being fed information. And I think finding spaces where we're not taking in information and trying to process and reflect instead is quite an important practice. And for me, that's an element of writing and theatre making as well. Before kind of,
so it's not stressful to be writing and theatre making. It's something that you find relaxing. You don't have to struggle with creativity.
I think rather than relaxing, I think that's the thing about resting that I'm not sure I'm 100% on board with. We have this idea that resting is like a relaxation or dissipation, something leaving us, you know. I think rather than leaving us, I think it's still there, but it settles. So for me, writing isn't necessarily a way to solve and therefore kind of get rid of problems, but rather to just process and give language to those problems and give perspective to those problems and put them in a place where I can kind of hold them and look at them and go, actually, I can deal with this and this is okay and I can hold this, you know.
So yeah. That spoken word piece that you shared with Take It From Us, does that have a title?
It does. It's called Time Bomb. It's called Time Bomb, which is kind of the major metaphor, analogy, I forget which, of the piece, yeah.
I mean, going back to that mugging that could have been a trigger for you, I mean, that was a bit like a time bomb.
It was, really. I suppose you can never really prepare for your first psychotic episode, right? I mean,
but it was triggered by something else, wasn't it?
Yeah, triggered by something.
By an assault and a mugging.
I think, yeah, life just happens, right? There's an important lesson in theatre that I apply to life a lot, which is plot just happens. Sometimes as actors, and this is talking in that kind of jargon, I suppose, sometimes as actors we prepare for the obstacles that come at us in a play and we don't react with them, we prepare. Life doesn't let us prepare so much, you know, and that mugging, yeah, was exactly a case of that. I did not expect that at 3 p.m. on, I think it was a Tuesday.
But if we're fearful of those sorts of things happening, then we tend to live our life much more in fear than living in the now, don't we? I mean, I've been often fearful of the future or fearful of a big presentation that I had to do or just fearful of providing for a young family and paying the mortgage. But essentially, if I live in the now, well, I've got sufficient money to pay the mortgage and I'm doing okay as a father and a husband and and so it's okay. It's okay then. But if we start becoming fearful of what might happen in the future, it just seems to me it amps up the overwhelm.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think a big part of it as well is relaxing our expectations. I think when we talk about being in the moment, and that's something that we hear in mental health and theatre and life in general, I suppose. When we talk about being in the moment, there's almost like this pressure that's suddenly put on you to put horse blinders on, you know, to have that real specific focus on what's happening now. And I can't think about what I'm doing tonight and I can't think about what happened this morning. I have to be in the moment. And ironically, it becomes a really stressful thing. I think so. I think part of that thing of letting things settle, you know, thinking about, I mean, in terms of issues that I'm thinking about, what I'm going to cook for dinner tonight is in the future, but is also in the now as well. Like, that's something that I'm considering.
Well, it's a reality. Yeah. I mean, before I came to Planet FM, I went to a little fruit shop to buy some good, healthy fruit and veggies. Well, that is preparation for what I might do this evening. So I suppose we can't be in the now all the time. But one of the things in Time Bomb, in the spoken word piece, is quite a bit of mention of breathing.
Yes, is
breathing important to your mental health?
Absolutely. Breathing. The two best things that we've talked about, walking and breathing. I love it.
Really?
Well, actually, it makes a whole load of sense. Basic human functions, you'd think they'd be some of the most important. Yeah, no breathing is so vital, I think, for everyone.
Have you got a particular technique which you find very helpful to your well-being?
I think the one piece of advice that I could give, or the one thing that has worked for me, exhale fully. Yeah, breathe in for four, hold for four, exhale completely. Yeah, you want to
for four or for maybe even six.
Well, it depends. I'd say you want to exhale for at least twice as long as you inhale.
Right.
Yeah, part of that panic response in switching our the systems in our body. Mm. Part of panic is about taking in too much breath rather than exhaling. I do not know the science about it. I'm about to blunder this completely.
But I mean, maybe we're trying to take in too much generally from social media and from life and from TV.
What a metaphor.
well, we better take another music break. And today on Take It From Us, we are playing Crowded House.
Well, my auntie lies from the land.
It's Kiwi band Crowded House, and today we are talking on Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us, to Daniel Goodwin. And I just said to Daniel in the break that perhaps we may not have cracked the question of how Daniel's work in theatre and art and poetry helps his well-being, helps his, I guess, conquering vulnerability, mental health vulnerability, and maintain stability and security. Is that a question, Daniel? I don't know whether I posed the question or not.
I can take that as a question. I think I know what it is. I think for me it ties back into the thing of language, and it ties back into that thing of empowering on a personal and subjective level. You know, for me, poetry and theatre and creativity is about taking the experiences, taking my experiences and my perspectives, and through theatre giving them shape, and through poetry giving them language and metaphor and expression. It's for me, it's about finding the right way of saying it for me, and then communicating that to other people. It's ironic, but it's quite funny. People often tell me, oh, you're a writer, you must be phenomenal at communication. And to be honest, it's the opposite, I think. I think one of the reasons that I'm a writer and a poet and I enjoy working with words so much is so often in just conversation, I find it so difficult to kind of articulate myself. And for me, going into the arts became a way of taking control of that and taking control of myself and the way that I express myself. You know, it became a really uplifting thing in that sense. It became really empowering in that sense.
Well, you're a very articulate radio guest.
Oh, thank you.
Have you not always been as confident in articulating and using language? I mean, has that been one positive spin-offs of doing what you're doing?
Absolutely. The thing, we talk about silver linings in mental health, and the one that people go to a lot is, but you, that horrible thing of, bipolar people are so creative. So you must be a great artist. And there is truth to that cliche. I don't like the cliche, but there is truth to it in the sense that you can't not address your own mental health. And that's true of everyone. You can't not overlook something.
Can't be in denial.
You can't be in denial about it. Again, that thing about the world moving quite quickly, I think increasingly we try to take things for granted. And when our mental health kind of stutters a bit, you can't. You have to address it, and you have to really encounter it. And by encountering it, encounter yourself as well and challenge those ideas of who you are and what your sense of self is and how you express yourself and how you operate in the world around you. When the expectation of yourself, again, that reincorporation,
but I mean, some people when their mental health stutters, they might isolate. They might disappear.
Yeah, there's that thing. I think when our mental health kind of, I don't want to say goes wrong, when our mental health reacts to the world in a way that we don't expect it to, a lot of the time we panic. And we don't have the words for it. And no one has the words for it often. Doctors, schizophrenia doesn't mean that much. You know, people, we don't know what those terms mean a lot of the time. And these experiences are so subjective. And I think we panic and we isolate ourselves because we no longer have a way of connecting to the world around us, to people around us. The thing that Atify, again, that thing of creating space, the thing that we try and do is create a space where people can find that connection again and take the time to find that connection again in whatever form it needs to take. The thing that my creativity, to address that last question, has given me is a very specific way of connecting with people again, which is something I lost for a little while when these experiences started happening.
But I mean, surely panic, when our mental health stutters, if we panic, I would think that's probably the worst thing that could happen. I mean, that I've panicked when I've felt those sort of that vulnerability start again. And oh my God, I'm going to end up in an acute psychiatric unit. I won't be able to work. I won't be able to play my tennis and live my life. That sort of thinking is, well, it just ensures that I go down the spiral very, very quickly. And I think breathing and meditation, they are two things which I can sort of fall back on, walking maybe not as obsessively as
not for 68 hours
walking around the Orewa mud flats, but so when your mental health stutters, what would be the first thing that you would do?
I think for me, and it goes back to walking actually, and it goes to breathing, and it goes to creativity as well, it's about finding ways to stretch it out. When we talk about panic, it's immediate and it's fast and it's all over the place and it's hard to settle in on anything or solve any of these problems because they're moving so quickly. I think what these all of these kind of routines, tennis, have in common is they give us a space and they give us an extended time frame to process and to work through and understand what's happening to us. I think when we start to take away those resources, those tools, when we cut funding to the arts or when we are institutionalized and things, you know, I think what happens is we lose those ways of communicating and taking space and understanding ourselves. And I think that's why so often our experiences last a little bit longer or get worse sometimes, God forbid, because we don't have those resources to stretch them out and ground ourselves and place ourselves in the world again and how we relate to the world, you know.
I mean, art is often a very personal thing, isn't it? And your spoken word piece, Time Bomb, I mean, people might love it and people might not love it. How do you react if the reaction is negative? Does that hit you?
Oh, absolutely. My the way that I approach any kind of creative thing, I suppose, you can only ever really go 50% in a conversation. I remember a director once told me, you can only ever go 50%. An actor and an audience have to come the other 50, you know. The interesting thing, I think, for me is when people come with a positive or a negative reaction, when it's strong, they're still coming that 50%. They're still engaging with you. And whatever that is, I can kind of work with. I think the hardest thing as an artist to deal with is when people don't respond to your work at all, when people don't come that 50%. When they don't come anything, you know, when they just pass you over, I think that's the hardest thing to deal with, because that's not a conversation. You can't work with that, you know?
Well, there was one point at the Shared Vision Celebration of Community Wellbeing last month in Northgate, which was run by Shared Vision and Hearts and Minds, I think, where there didn't seem to be a whole lot of response and reaction from the crowd, and it was only when the MC actually sought that we got feedback and we got response. It wasn't necessarily about the messages that had come creatively from the team at Adify. It some of these people just wanted to talk about mental health, and some of them had a bit of an agenda where they wanted to promote certain things.
I think everyone's got an agenda. And actually, agenda is an interesting word that we can kind of reframe. Everyone's got something that they want to say. Everyone has a way of understanding the world that is their own, and everyone has a need, a human need, to share that and have someone respond to it, you know? That's true of everyone.
So very important to listen to those opinions.
I think so.
And be available. And we have one mouth and two ears, and use them in that proportion.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Bonnie's fantastic, my boss at Atify.
Right.
He's so good at facilitating those spaces.
Bonnie was the MC for that particular function in Northgate. Well, we've just time to thank Daniel for coming in to talk to us at Take It From Us and to shine some light on creative approaches to well-being. Thank you, Daniel.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
Now, coming up in Wellington, this is early December, there is a major workshop called Delivering Mental Health Transformation in New Zealand. It's going to be held between the 4th and the 5th of December at Te Whare Waka Tapiri in Wellington. Some high-level speakers, and it's also going to give you the opportunity to hear from the panel members who guided the government inquiry into mental health and addiction. Now, if you'd like to know more about this, you can go to the website at conference, conference.co.nz/mental health, or you can actually email to get more information at register@conference. That's conference.co.nz. So there are some super saver and early bird savings to be had at that workshop. So that is Delivering Mental Health Transformation in New Zealand.